Your weekly pulse on the Milwaukee Bucks, straight from a Bucks legend. This is Here District with Marcus Johnson, alongside his son and 1995 NCAA champion, Chris. Here's MJ.
Hey, hey, welcome to Here District, the fantastic voyage. I am the captain of this vessel, Marcus Johnson, joined by my son, Chris Johnson. What's up, Chris?
What's up, MJ?
It's all good, man. Where can if the people want to hear the Here District, man, what shall they do?
Well, they got to subscribe to the Bucks official YouTube channel. You can find us there. Okay. You can find us on Apple, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcast. Make sure you follow us on Twitter at Bucks Plus Audio.
That's good stuff. And so now let's get right into it. We got a return visit, which is always good. I guess we were okay with him the first time around, even though it was during the playoffs.
Yes, indeed.
We got eliminated, I believe, in game five after just that first appearance. But
the cameo.
Got a quick cameo. Nekias Duncan, host of the Dunker Spot podcast on Yahoo Sports Network, a contributing writer for Yahoo Sports and Bleacher Report. Thanks, man, for coming back. Welcome to Here District, Nekias.
Thank you for having me back. I will try not to be a bad luck charm, I suppose, this time around. Yeah. Hopefully, we got a little bit more staying power on this trip. But always a pleasure to chop it up with y'all.
Absolutely.
And that's carried over to this season with Kevin Porter Jr., obviously, with the ankle sprain game one, the meniscus. And that's where I want to start, Nekias. I mean, how much do you think his return in a 3 weeks, a month, whatever it's going to be in terms of when he's ready to get back on the floor. How much did that injury hurt the Bucks, and what does him coming back, how much will you think that will help the Bucks?
I think it's been interesting watching Milwaukee navigate the absence, because I think with him being out, that has naturally provided more of a runway for Ryan Rollins, who gave good minutes last year and has just completely taken off. This season, he's been one of the best stories in all of basketball, honestly, with the way that he's played on both ends of the floor. So you have that runway. And I think in relation to KPJ, whenever he does make his return, I think you immediately feel it in the non-Giannis minutes. Just having another guy that can generate some offense for you when Giannis does have to take a break, I think would be a big bit for the Milwaukee Bucks, who I think as of recording, the offense is around 20 points worse per 100 possessions when Giannis goes to the bench. That is not a tenable number for a team that has serious playoff aspirations. So if nothing else, having another ball handler, a guy that can get busy and pick and roll, a guy that can score in isolation, it should take some of that pressure off of those units when Giannis isn't on the floor.
All right, the old cliche, look into your crystal ball, but what does Doc do once KPJ returns? Who's the odd man out?
Ooh, I don't know if there has to be an odd man out. Like, I wouldn't mind him in the second unit with Cole Anthony, see how you can kind of stagger that way. But if you do want to incorporate him back into the starting unit, like, I would guess it's probably Gary Trent Jr., because I don't think you take AJ Green out with the way that he shot the ball. And something that we talked about the last time we were on, the screening chemistry that he has with Giannis and the way that they can invert things and put pressure on defenses, I wouldn't want to take that part away. So, if he's going to remain a starter, I think he takes Gary Trent Jr.'s spot. If not, I don't mind easing him in with the second unit.
Chris?
Well, I mean, I just feel like there's the way the Bucks offense kind of has their lulls and stalls, and the metrics show that they're not doing well. Things like last 4 seconds in the shot clock. That tells me, like, you need a KPJ in that starting lineup because of his ability to create and break down guys. For me, when you talk about the odd man out, I mean, it's got to be Cole Anthony as far as getting minutes reduced at this, you know, point in the season if KPJ were to come back. I don't know how long he's going to be coming back.
You mean Gary Trent? You mean Gary Trent, not Cole?
Well, I don't mean the, like, who's going to he's going to replace? In the
you're talking about overall minutes.
I'm talking about minutes. I think a drastic reduction in Cole Anthony's stuff, more like concerted efforts to get AJ Green better looks. Like, I don't think he's shooting it enough. I mean, that's a guy you got to get at least, you know, 10, 12 threes a game, in my opinion. I mean, you know, good looks, and not just afterthought looks, like those type of looks. We can talk about this, you know, a little bit later, but, you know, just the concept of this whole Doc Rivers, Eric Name did a great piece on it. The all bench lineup, the non, you know, where he's keeping Giannis and Miles. like that has to change. I mean, look, we. I got a lot.
It started to.
I'll stay on where we're at. I won't
keep yeah, I want to be able to go to work next week, Chris. Please, make tread lightly with the critiques, please. I'll be getting emails like, "Yeah, can you tell your son to chill the hell out?" Jesus Christ! No. I'm just being facetious, but I'm leading to a point here. And I want to get you guys, your take on this, Nikias, first. And you mentioned AJ. Now, and we talked about this, Chris, at the start of the season. Teams are targeting AJ and his lack of size. When I say that, he's 6'4". I mean, he battles, he fights. But oftentimes, against these talented wings in this league, and Eric Name mentioned this and may have pointed it out in his 12 things to know about the Bucks after 12 games. But AJ has 19 first quarter fouls. I think there's like two or three players in the league with more than 10. He's got 19 first quarter fouls. And so it seems like opposing coaches, Nikias, are saying, okay, kid's a great shooter, but, you know, this ain't football. You don't get to come out after offense. You got to play some defense. And the way the refs are calling his fouls, when he's being aggressive physically, trying to stand guys up, trying to battle down in the, I mean, he's not getting any calls. I mean, they're calling every single, and they're contact fouls. Don't get me wrong, there's contact. It's not like he's not touching guys. He's battling. He's fighting. I don't know. So here's my hypothetical. What if if AJ, you took him out of the starting lineup just for now? I'm not even talking about KPJ. I was just thinking, how would he perform with the bench crew? And what if you brought a guy like Amir Coffey into the starting lineup at 6'7", defensive-minded, not looking to – doesn't need the ball, doesn't need to shoot, can shoot 40% from the three-point line last year. I don't know. Do you think we're at a point now where you need to consider some kind of way to protect AJ in terms of him being able to establish some rhythm by staying on the floor? And I just see his the molecular structure, like I like to say, and his face. He's getting frustrated early, and I don't know if that's starting to carry over into him shooting not as well as he's capable of. So I don't know. What's your thoughts on that? Just the AJ and the foul, the 19 first quarter fouls. Let's start there and then roll with it.
Okay, that's one heck of a stat pool. First and foremost, it kind of reminds me of just putting the Heat hat on very quickly. It kind of reminds me of that Duncan Robinson era. Like, even when he would have the possessions where he'd win, if he beats a guy to a spot and it looks like there's physicality, he's just not getting the benefit of the doubt on that. So it feels like there's a little bit of that. And I feel like a lot of players and a lot of shooters, period, just kind of have to battle through that rep. As far as replacing him for an Amir Coffey, I could see the argument. I think I would worry about, again, losing the screening element that AJ provides on and off the ball. Yeah. And as we're talking about 3-point volume, like, at that point, Gary's kind of your only guy that's going to get him up with legitimate volume. And if teams are more comfortable being physical with him, or they're switching any of the off-ball stuff that they're running with Gary, like, Amir hasn't been high-volume guy. Yeah. So I kind of worry about what that means for – what does that mean for the Giannis touches now? Do we see him – he's been one of the most double-team players in the league this year and for many years in a row. Yeah. But this year it's kind of gone up. Do you see that rate get even higher now if AJ Green goes to the bench? And so I get the argument for getting AJ more comfortable, saving some of those fouls. If he's in the second unit with like a guy like Cole or something like that, maybe he feels more free to get shots up that he normally wouldn't take while he's sharing the floor with Giannis. But I feel like too much of the shot profile, too much of the overall diet would shift. Not that it couldn't work, but I don't know if I'd feel comfortable with making that move.
I'm just pulling it out the depths of my behind. I'm just throwing some stuff out there. I was just kind of driving over here thinking about, you know, I always think about like what you can do chemistry wise to kind of change the pull a rabbit out of my hat.
The depths of your behind.
Pull a rabbit out of my behind. But you know, so I was trying to think like you know, if you did, because that stat that Eric Name pointed out, 19 first quarter fouls, and nobody else with more than a couple of guys with just around 10. It's just crazy. So I'm like, well, do you need to protect him more from himself? And you know, so I don't know, Chris, where do you go with that?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I like his value on the floor. I don't, you know, I like it. You know, regardless of if he's fouling or if he's, you know, not making shots, he still has that gravity aspect that is still going to help open things up. I think, you know, I think Doc figuring out kind of, you know, the trans, like when I'm looking at the synergy, the Bucks transition below average this year versus last year, very good. You know, I think figuring that part out, you know, is like, how do we get more looks, more easy looks in transition? Obviously, when they get in the half court, they've been one of the better teams in the league in half court. Yeah. But I think they have to work too hard. I think they have to work too hard to get buckets on offense every time down. It feels like they're working too hard. And I don't know if that's taking something away on the defensive end. But, you know, I think that's like, if you had to, you know, what are the top kind of, after 12 games, couple of factors that we need to tighten up. I think transition would be obviously number one. And then the little things after timeouts and last 4 seconds of the shot clock, when frankly, you know, Dame Lillard last year, you know, last 4 seconds, I mean, that's Dame time. That's when he was able to create. That's when you had a guy that had a little bit more confidence in his on the ball, break you down, get a jumper up stuff than Ryan Rollins currently does. So yeah. I think figuring that part out is going to be really interesting as far as the next 12 games and how the Bucks are going to rebound from this.
And Doc's talked about, I mean, just the lack of ball. This is kind of a recurring thing with Doc in press conferences after game. After the Charlotte game, and we didn't move to basketball and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And but that Charlotte game showed me something, and Doc mentioned it. Doc started off the press conference saying, you know, AJ and Gary Trent need to really have a serious appreciation for the value of Giannis after mm-hmm. after that game.
There is just a level of randomness during regular season basketball. And I think broader strokes with this Bucks team, and I know we were going to get into it, it really kind of highlighted where they've had their missteps defensively this year and how inconsistent they've been as they've made some tweaks to how often they want to switch, where they want to send help from, when they want to send it, and those kind of things. And I think with a team like Charlotte, that has been a pretty good offense all year long. They've been elite with LaMelo, but naturally he's been out. But with a team that wants to play that fast, that moves as quickly and as well as they do, they're fine going side to side, versatile screeners and everything like that, it puts more of a spotlight on, okay, if you're switching, how tidy are these switches going to be? If you do mess up, what is your chemistry like in trying to clean up some messes on the fly? And in those minutes, you're just seeing multiple high screen. We got two on one because we don't know if this is going to be a switch or if you're staying attached. And now Charlotte's just playing advantage basketball. And something that, you know, my guy and the guy that y'all had on, Steve Jones, says all the time, even the bad offenses in the league today are much better at taking advantage of defenses when they're in rotation than they were 5 years ago, 10 years ago, et cetera. Anybody can get you kind of on that hamster wheel if you're not tidy. And so I think there was just a lot of Charlotte playing with tempo, early screening actions. Sometimes we're staying attached. Other times I think you're switching, but you're not really switching.
Yeah.
Now it's two on the ball, and now it's just pinging all over the place. So it's just an area that Milwaukee has to be tidier with overall.
Well, and that's a great point, Nikias. And I call it – I know this is totally non-politically incorrect or correct or whatever, but
– Uh-oh, kind of be ADHD, careful, MJ.
This ADHD generation of – because you walk through this stuff – they walk through it. Chris, they walk through it and shoot around. Just, you know, the whole concept of shoot around going into this Charlotte game was to take away the Hornets' joy. Their joy is offense and movement and rhythm and side to side and playing free and slipping and doing all these cute things. Well, no, we're going to keep the ball on what side of the floor. When we switch, we go, you know, knock the crap out of the guy you switch on to, push that screen up, you know, all these things. Greg Buckner is like, this was the game plan going in, even though Spencer Rivers was the guy responsible for this scout. But this was all the things they talked about. And then you watch it on the floor. And as you say, the guys, there's lack of communication. There's two guys going, to the ball. And they're Kalkbrenner with just real basic slips, able to just get right down the middle of the I mean, and I understand coaching is a lot more sophisticated than back in my day, and Charles Lee is a really bright young coach who I really, really think is going to be successful in this league. And so you get some misdirection to start off, you know. But God, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I could go belabor the point, but you get what I'm saying, man. It's just to your point, Nikias. I mean, it's just the breakdowns, and that's been a season long plague for this team. It's just. The transition from shoot around to actual game and staying focused with what we're doing, you know. And Doc has talked about it. We talk about it. We tell these guys, And I don't know. It's just a disconnect somewhere. What's that about, Chris? You're closer to this generation than I am. You're in the college world. What's going on? What's that about?
I don't know if it's generational, man. I don't know if it's just, you know, these guys. I don't, you know, maybe the defensive IQ acumen for this particular group when they're together, man, like they haven't gelled, they haven't figured out that chemistry. I mean, MJ, you know, did every team you play on, you guys just gelled automatically from day one? You know, did it take you some time? I'm sure that, you know, some of the best defensive units are going to take a little time. I'm not saying this crew is going to be one of the best defensive units, but to be serviceable, to not be 29th in whatever rebound percentage and not be 27th and sending opponents to the free throw line every game. I mean, you got to start with the fundamentals and basics on defense, right? I mean, even at the highest level, you just got to be about blocking out, technique, finding the man. And it's also going to be about playing defense without fouling. Now, I know the officials haven't been necessarily, you know, cool to the Bucks at all this season. It's been some really janky stuff, but that shouldn't, you know, affect, you know, how you, you know, go about your business on the defensive end. So I think they just got to start with the fundamentals, man. Get back to the basics. Doc needs to just strip this thing down. Just get back to basics, man. Simplify some things for guys so that they can get on the same page.
I'm curious to see, like, what simplifying the defense would look like within this context. Because I think one of the things that I was kind of excited about this year, just kind of looking at the roster, I was high on Milwaukee coming into the season. I still am. It's like, okay, I think this is going to be naturally on offense. A lot of Giannis shooting around them. They're going to take more threes. That kind of speaks for itself. Defensively, I thought this was going to be a team that switches more than they did last year with the personnel that they had. And I was more so thinking they'd switch more 1-4. They've switched Miles Turner a lot more than I thought they were going to this year, and that has been a bit of an adventure on some of this stuff. But I think with them going from, they switched at like the 18th highest rate in the league last year, they're up to 6th this year. Just a huge shift in the way that they want to go about defending ball screens in particular.
What was that number again? What was that number again? Repeat that number. Last year was, were they ranked last year and switched?
Last year, they switched at the 18th highest rate in the league.
Okay.
And this year, that is up to 6th, just outside the top 5. So massive shift in the way that they want to approach that. And so you would think, or at least I would think, okay, that is kind of like simplifying things. We're just going to keep the ball in front. We want to stay attached to shooters. This is the second year in a row where we're not allowing a bunch of threes, or a high percentage of threes at the very least. But the point of attack stuff has just been weird with some of these switches. I don't really know why there have been so many lapses. And like, even Giannis has been a part of so many of those lapses, as much as I've loved this season. It's kind of concerning. So that's where I'm just like, this should be something that corrects itself, but it's been weird.
There was a ball screen, big little for Charlotte, but Trey Mann. And then so Miles Turner switches on Trey Mann right at the top. Mm-hmm. But just kind of gives him a lane going right. All the congestion is on the left side. You've got a shooter, maybe Knipple or somebody in that right corner that Kyle Kuzma's got to kind of stay home on. But then that kind of switching, you know, and Miles, when he has Turner, when he's gotten down and really focused on moving his feet and staying in front of, I mean, he's done a great job. But it's just, that's what I mean about just a disconnect between, you know, where I'm supposed to send him and where my help is supposed to come from. And by the time you figure that thing out, Trey Mann's at the cup. You know, I know you don't want to give Trey a 3-point shot, so you got to step up on him. And he's quicker than Miles. It was a foot race and all that good stuff. But yeah, those are the kinds of plays, the breakdowns defensively that just look like there's some confusion in terms of, you know, assignments and responsibilities. Go ahead, Chris.
Like when you lose Brooke and you bring in Miles and you kind of, everybody's kind of saying like, you know, Miles is going to do a lot of the same things. And I don't know, I haven't looked at the data as far as who's been better defensively. I probably say Miles has been, but with losing Brooke now and bringing in Miles, and now you have Bobby Portis, like sort of trying to be, you know, a defensive anchor in some of those units. And it's just not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. So I don't know how that we're going to fix that. But, you know, he's not a rim protector. He's just not, you know, or he's not a pick and roll deterrent guy. He's just kind of, you know, he'd be trying. I love Bobby to death, but it hasn't been as effective as you like defensively. So I don't know. Doc has to figure some things out. I don't know if you tinker with the rotation. I don't know what you do, but something you need to figure out.
So then that leads me to my next point of discussion here. You guys talked about Brooke, or you did, Chris. Offensive rebounding for the opponent. I mean, God dang. And the thing about Brooke, and I was pointing this out to some of our people, broadcast people, media people at the back of the plane where we sit. Sometimes there's meals, sometimes there's not, but it's all good. But we were talking about the offensive rebounding. Dave Kane, our radio guy, who's a radio guy in Virginia with Tony Bennett when they won a national championship. He's seen some good teams. But he was like, what's going on? And so now you got a 45, 46% offensive rebounding percentage last night. But then I go back to Houston that had 50%, both halves, 52 and 50 or something like that, but finished above 50%. Now, they're leading the league over 40%, the only team, but God dang, 50. But, you know, it's almost like you just chalk it up as, well, they're a great rebounding team and we're not. But that's that Brooke piece. Brooke doesn't average more than 5 or 6 rebounds, but he does a great job of finding that most dangerous Steven Adams, Musa
Diabate,
you know, and making sure, even though Diabate did have 10 offensive rebounds against us last November, right around your birthday, Chris, around the 18th of November last season. So I don't know. I mean, you think the guys, you know, you kind of crunch the numbers on this stuff. How much will that continue to really, really hurt the Bucks if you give a team 14, 15, 20 offensive rebounds like the Rockets had when we played them?
I'm glad you hit on the rebounding because I was going to if you didn't. Like, that's been a real big problem for Milwaukee this year. Last year, they were 6th in defensive rebound rate, so doing a great job of ending possessions. You mentioned the Brook of it all, the way that he's able to box out and clear space for Giannis and others to kind of roam in and get those boards. This year, they're down to 25th, and that is just untenable for a team with the aspirations that they have. And I think a good bit of that can be tied to the uptick in switching, because naturally, if Giannis is switching out and he's on the perimeter, and then you run another action and you get Miles Turner switched out, your size is high on the floor. And so even if you're able to force a miss at the rim, which the Bucks are also allowing more shots at the rim than they did last year, now you're just getting those second opportunities because Giannis is out of frame, Miles Turner is out of frame. And again, we talked a little bit about Giannis and the defensive things from him this year. Sometimes he's in frame and he's not finding bodies. Like, again, little things that I trust Giannis can clean up when he really revs up. But as part of the collective, he's not always holding up his end of the bargain on that front. And that's where you get all these extra opportunities on top of that. And so I wonder, circling back to your point about simplifying things defensively, do we get to a point where Doc is like, okay, let's dial back some of the switching. We're just going to keep all these ball screens on the side, or we're just going to go to more drop coverage. We just have to make sure that one or both of our bigs are just close to the basket to solve this problem. We don't have the best screen navigators overall, but we just have to pick a poison. It's either going to be we live with the screen navigation or whatever it is, but we're ending more possessions, or we're going to continue to switch like this. We're going to limit the three-point attempts, and we just have to do our best on the offensive glass. Like, I think that's kind of where an inflection point may come with this Bucks defense.
Yeah, and Doc talked about that second unit in particular not rebounding well, and then I think he was asked, well, how do you change that? It's like, well, hey, something, you know, either you rebound or you don't. But I'm wondering, and Chris, jump in on this too. So the Bucks are playing more possessions of zone defense this year. It's, you know, they played about 4.5% defensive possession zone. I think it's up to about 6 or 7%. I mean, it's an increased amount. Yeah, that old adage, Chris, about, you know, it's tougher to locate box outs and locate bodies in a zone.
Yeah.
I mean, does that factor into that, or is it just what? You tell me.
I don't know. I've never subscribed to that. I always felt like you could rebound better in a zone.
Yeah.
But you cannot win in the NBA giving up this many offensive rebounds and
extra possessions, extra possessions. Give these guys as talented as these guys are. Yeah, and oftentimes that's a 3-point shot because that's that high volume 3-point deal that everybody's going to now. So you get a steal, you get an offensive rebound. It's an automatic three. And like the Trey Manns against Charlotte the other night, I mean, he killed us on a couple of. I mean, you know what I mean? It's so. I mean, but that's. I don't know. I just can't chalk it up too well. You know, I don't know. It just seems like it's like you're saying, Chris. It's a per. Do you go bigger? I mean, he went with Dallas. He went with Giannis, Bobby, and Kyle Kuzma. Like all 12 minutes in the fourth quarter, along with Ryan Rollins, and I forgot who else is in there. But I mean,
I want to get Nekias' take on that. What do you think about the big lineup, Nekias?
I am intrigued by it. It's one of those, I don't know how often I want to see them go to it. The question I was going to pose to you as you were talking about the second unit is like, how much Jericho Sims do you want to see? Because I feel like it's been very spotty minutes for him. Like, certainly has the size, it has the vertical, but like still a more slender body that could be moved around a little bit. I wonder how much you want to see more of him. But I guess just overall big thoughts.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I like Jericho a lot. I mean, you know, one thing he does, and he did it on a couple occasions against Charlotte, if he can't get to it, he's going to he's going to tip it out. Now, they may regain possession or whatever. But he's going to fight as hard as a Musa Diabate fights, you know, for that rebound. Now, whether or not the quickness factor plays into him coming up with a rebound or not, but now offensively, you know, are you playing 4-on-5, you know, because you know, you got to find ways to involve him on roles, creative ways as a roller going. I'm not even crazy about him as a short roller, just having to make a decision, you know, in right inside the free throw line and the dotted on the move. Now he's got it. Now, you know, I'm the jury's still out for me on that.
He's got to be a vertical threat whenever he's in the game, man. You got to be looking for him and throwing it up and letting him go get stuff. Like, that has to be his sort of role. When he comes in the game on offense, get the crowd hype. If we're at home, if we're on the road, whatever, shutting up the crowd, like, get Jericho some dunks. I mean, he doesn't have the greatest hands.
Yeah.
So like, and he can't really shoot it like that. But so you gotta like, okay, if we're not confident in him doing that, well, at least throw it up there two or three times. I've always wanted to see him and Giannis work, you know, Giannis kind of working and throwing that lob to him from the short corner, from the dunker spot. But again, you gotta do something, man.
Now, Dylan Carter just handed me a stat here. So the combination of Giannis, Kuzma, and Miles are a 30.2 net in 35 minutes together. That do anything for you guys? Is that your close? He doesn't. Has Miles been a closer? Sporadically, not. I mean, in Dallas, he wasn't on the floor. It was Bobby, Giannis, and Kuz. But when you hear numbers like that, and those are the kind of numbers that they were talking about with Kevin Porter Jr. and the triumvirate, Gary Trent and AJ, and Doc started that unit Game 5. I mean, what does that say to you? Nikias, when you hear we're here 30 plus net in 35 minutes on the court together, shake up in order or just a redistribution of how you use these guys during the course of a game?
I think if nothing else, it kind of raises the brow. Like something that I had in my notes is we were going to talk about Giannis and Miles Turner. Giannis has played 89 minutes without Miles so far. The Bucks have outscored teams by 30 points in those minutes, about a plus 13 net rating in those groups. And so, as you mentioned, that three-man grouping, like, that obviously fits into that window as well. And so, for me, it's like, okay, when can we get to that look more than anything? Like, I don't think that should be the automatic, this is the closing lineup all the time. Like, if you're facing Houston, can we get bigger and do that? When we are facing Orlando, can we close a game like that? Like, that's more of where it's like, okay, it's work. Can this continue to work against these types of teams? And then from there, if that success continues, all right, well, let's try it against these smaller teams and see if we can win the possession battle there. Let's build some counters to see how teams are guarding us. Can we build some stuff out? So then, you know, as you add that data, you get into the playoffs, like, oh, we know in the back pocket, we can go to this counter if we need to. Like, I'm all for that kind of experimentation, but 35 minutes, I need to see a little bit more before I'm ready to have a firm take on it.
Yeah, yeah.
How much do you experiment, though? Like, if you're Doc, like, in the next, say, 5 to 7 games, how much of this group are you going to throw out there at what points of the game? Like, you know, are you trying to get these guys together to close the half, to close the third? You know, talk to me about that.
I think because, you know, again, y'all can follow the Bucks closer than I do, but it feels like it's been like Giannis plays the first 7-8 minutes, takes a little break, comes back in at the end of the first. That's kind of been like the split for him. So, like, I think you can kind of time it out like in the first quarter or just end of quarters. Or start of second, that kind of thing. I think you can kind of slip those minutes in, especially if you are not like a fan of the all bench units that they get into. So when you get into some of the Giannis-centric stuff, like that's when you can kind of sprinkle that in. So like, I don't mind it. And again, it's going to probably be more like opponent based for me with that alignment in particular to anything. But that's probably when I try to sprinkle it in.
Nikias, you have a chance to watch the Dallas Maverick game. I don't know if you did or not, Chris, but man, it was such an interest. It was fascinating. The mind games that Jason Kidd was playing with Giannis out there. And I said it on the air that he's trying to rent space in Giannis' head. And at a certain point, when Jason called a timeout late in the game, Giannis is like, I'm giving you an eviction notice. You got 24 hours to get your crap out of my head. You know, can I get my security deposit back? No, get your crap out of my head. But to that point, and Giannis shared this with me. At halftime, he told me that he had like 7 points. You know, what Giannis did that first quarter, Chris DeKais, he didn't shoot at all. He had a couple of normal jump hook. Kind of almost could get to the rim on a layup. He didn't take one field goal attempt. That hadn't happened since 2022, 2021 or something. He didn't take one field goal attempt in that first quarter. And I thought it was to prove a point. It's like, okay, Jason, I know you're getting ready to do something, but I'm going to show you that I'm a different person. I'm not going to come out here and win the battle and lose the war, score 50 and we lose. I'm not going to take this personally. And so he came out as a passer. Which was beautiful. Came out the second half attacking, whatever. But Giannis shared with me at halftime that he had 7 points or so at halftime, and the Bucks were losing. Jason kind of walked up to him, patted him on the back. "You're having a great game." And Giannis is like, "I got 7 points. We're losing. And he's telling me I'm having a great game." I mean, I was like, "This dude is trying to get in my head, you know." But then Giannis was able, and the play that exemplified it more so than any other to me was when Gafford kind of bulldozed him down real aggressively, and as opposed to Giannis complaining or fighting or getting up, and he just stayed down.
Just got right.
He collected himself. He went to the free throw line and hit his two free throws. And to me he had 15 points going into the fourth, and I said on the air he's still gonna finish with 30. I mean, 15 for him in a quarter is nothing, and he finished right at 30 points. But did you have a chance to watch any of that, man? And just it doesn't surprise you, I'm sure, that Jason Kidd would take that approach.
Yeah, it's almost like Jason Kidd and Giannis have a prior relationship or something. It's kind of, it's kind of funny. But no, that was a funny bit, and I think even to that first half, as you were talking about. The way that he came out as a passer, like it's a very loud spotlight on just the kind of playmaker and the kind of thinker Giannis has grown into over the past few seasons. Like he has long been, again, one of the most prolific rim attackers that we have in the league. But the fact that he's been able to grow the passing package the way that he has, to where he's manipulating defenders now, I can displace you with these passes. Like he just does such a good job of reading the game. And I don't know if he gets enough credit for that aspect of it. And the fact that he can have that kind of self-awareness to, I know I'm going to get doubles, so I can kind of play my post possessions to goad you into these doubles and make these plays, have this kind of approach. And then if it isn't working, all right, yeah, let me just put my head down. 12 free throw attempts, does not matter. You can't stop me from getting to my spot. Knowing that you just have that baked in is such a luxury that not many other players in league history have had. But the fact that he's able to tap into the playmaker side, the thinker side, and then also I am the most unstoppable force in the league. You can't do anything about this. Let's just go home right now.
It reminds me of that old saying about how your parents of all people know how to push your buttons better than anybody else because they installed them. You know, so Jason, Jason and Giannis talked about, when he hit that big three and he pointed at Jason, it's still unclear exactly what he said. But afterwards he said, Jason wouldn't allow me to shoot any jumpers. He really, really stopped my development as an outside shooter, but based on the fact he told me not to shoot, so you can see, like you're saying, there's some prior baggage going on, even in Giannis's mind. And don't get it twisted. He loves Jason. I mean, Jason was instrumental in putting him at the point forward, putting the ball in his hands that one season. And he went crazy after the All-Star break, 18 points, 8 rebounds, 7 or 8 assists a game over the last 25 games or so. But Chris, I mean, just your opinion on something like that. I told Giannis, I was just really impressed, and I appreciate it, how he was able to win the mind game. And he hadn't always been able to win the mind game in situations like that.
No, I think that's what we've seen just with the evolution of Giannis. Like, he's starting to win the mind games. I mean, we saw him lose the mind game a little bit last year. Not really lose it, but, you saw some moments and some confrontations where you're kind of like, okay. But to see, you just understand that he takes his role serious, man. And he understands, like, how important it is for him to keep his stuff together. I think this is a, you know, just a bigger scheme thing, a bigger picture thing. And Giannis, man, like he wanted all this responsibility. He wanted to be the elder statesman. He wanted to be the one that everybody's looking to. And so because of that, in those type of moments, like you said, MJ, when he's laying on the floor, laying on the ground, collecting himself, who knows what he would have done, you know, a couple of years ago if the Nassas wouldn't have had to run out on the court and kind of, you know, grab him and hold him back or whatever. Just like you saw the other time when he hit the game winner. Like that to me, when he started doing the Sam Cassell big ball, the big balls thing. I don't know if you guys saw that part.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The onion grab.
Our guy that we had on the podcast, the Greek journalist Harris, I believe his name is, but he was Stavro. He was talking about what the Nassas was saying in Greek, and it was calm down. And to me, you saw kind of Giannis kind of chill, but that to me, that's growth as a leader. And it was indicative of that in the Dallas game as well.
So kind of wind down here with the, I don't want to say a dose of reality, but man, the Joker had, 52 points or whatever the other night? He's averaging, like, just triple-double again. So as well as Giannis is playing. I mean, Shea is OKC. Who they beat by 20? The Lakers? They killed somebody the other night. Yeah, the Lakers the other night. I mean, blew him. I mean, as well as Giannis is playing, Nikias, does he have a shot to finish first? Let me put it that way. But even, like, can he bump the Joker or Shea out of the first and second spot the way they're playing?
Well, this is a funny one for me because Giannis was my preseason MVP pick. So, like, I am inclined to say yes, he absolutely can.
Yeah.
If Jokic is doing, like, he's converting, like, nearly 80% of his shots inside the arc. It's just nonsensical what he's doing, averaging the triple-double. The Nuggets are winning. They're elite on both sides of the ball. Like, he's been part of that. The Shea of it all, like OKC might just win 70. Like it's one of those things. I need Giannis first and foremost. Let's make sure that knee is okay. That's just two games now that he's missed with the left knee. I want him to be healthy first and foremost. But beyond that, like I need the defense to ramp up for him because offensively it kind of speaks for himself. The scoring, the playmaking, like low volume, but he's making threes this year. Like that part is just going to be there. And as we mentioned a little bit earlier, like the Bucks offense is like 20 points better per 100 possessions with Giannis on the floor. That impact is very visible. The defense has just been kind of negligible in terms of like the net rating. It's pretty much the same with him on or off. And like that is well beneath the quality of defender that Giannis has proven to be throughout his career. So like you want to see more impact there. You don't want him to be as part of as many like breakdowns as has been the case so far this year. If the defense ramps up, you can get into Bucks top four seed. On-off splits are ridiculous. Yeah. Box score numbers are ridiculous. And then, hey, he's having a better two-way season than Jokic. He's having a better two-way season than Shea. Like, that's kind of how you'd have to build that argument. Because otherwise, what those two are doing, what Luka, I guess, sans that game against OKC, what Luka's been doing, what Wimby's been doing, like, it's going to get tough in that regard.
Yeah. For sure. I mean, you can only can control what you can control. And then finally, I mean, the Eastern Conference, as we record today, there's like seven teams within a game of each other. I mean, any of these teams you think are playing way over their head? I mean, can the Sixers sustain it with the Maxi and Edgecombe, the way they're doing their thing, and Embiid kind of sporadically? Can the Heat continue? Norman Powell is showing that he's legit and for real. The Raptors are playing better. The Bulls had that great start. The Magic is starting to play. I mean, who do you see kind of sustaining top five level play in Eastern Conference and who may be kind of fading as the season progresses?
Ooh, well, I think in terms of who's rising, like it is a positive. One, this Detroit start. We're talking about in division here, but like this Detroit start has been incredible. And this is with teams blitzing Cade all over the place. They haven't gotten the best 3-point shooting around that, but their defense has been incredible. That foundation should be pretty consistent for them. I don't know if they're going to be the one seed, but I think Detroit is just firmly going to be there. Mm. Cleveland, as they've gotten healthier, they're going to continue to stack wins. The New York Knicks, top 10 on both sides of the ball so far this year. The offense is opened up. The defense is still good. Like, I think they're going to be there. That's probably your core three right now, and that's where you get into Milwaukee four. Philadelphia, I have enjoyed them. The defense has been really rickety, and I feel like that's just kind of gone under the radar, considering how good Maxi and Edgecombe have been. They obviously need Joel Embiid to get to a better version of himself. You want to see that more in March than you do in November, but either way, that's where I'm just like, they're good, but these have been a whole lot of minutes for Maxey and Edgecombe, and Embiid doesn't look like himself. So any kind of injury to one of those threes where it's like, ooh, what does that look like? The Bulls slide has already started to happen, unfortunately. But yeah, they are still someone that – they're still a team that can score with just about anyone with the pace that they play at. But
Magic, are you – how high are you on the Magic? I mean, everybody thought that this would be a year.
Yeah, what's your thoughts on the Magic?
They could move into that upper echelon.
Do we have to talk about – I had the Magic as a top three seed this year. And I know. They – man. I tell you what. If they can get the defense back in order – then they have more margin for error to figure out what the offense is, because the offense has been naturally uneven. Like Desmond Bane not taking a lot of threes, much less making them to start the year. I think that's going to bounce back, but that's been weird. I like the way that Franz is playing. I like the way that Paolo is playing, especially now after a little bit of the cold start. Feels like there's been more refinement with the types of shots that he's taking, how deep he wants to drive to the basket. So, like, I still think the seeds are there for Orlando to be good. They just got to turn the defense around. Like, it just has not been what we're accustomed to seeing during the Jamal Mosley era. So if they get the defense back right, they are going to be a tough out for anyone, but I just need to see more consistency on that front.
Well, I mean, it's super, super log jam right now. It's still early, small sample size, but man, it looks like it's going to be an exciting kind of a Eastern Conference just in terms of jockeying for these play-in positions and first six positions. But we'll come back, man, and revisit that. Dekaius Duncan, I want to thank you for stopping by the Here District. Check out his podcast, The Dunker Spot, on Yahoo Sports Network, and then check him out also on Yahoo Sports and Bleacher Report as a contributing writer. Dekaius Duncan, man, as a pleasure as always, and come back and see us probably another 30 games or so. We'll revisit some of this stuff, man, and see where we are at that point, man. Thank you for spending some time with us.
Sounds good. Appreciate it as always. We're going to have some fun when I come back.
All right. Sounds good.
Absolutely.
Dekaius Duncan. All right, thank you to Dekaius Duncan. And you know, before he signed off, he had to give you a little bit of stuff, Chris, about Cole Anthony, hot and cold Anthony, man.
Look, I'm rolling with Cole Anthony, man. Yeah, I'm a believer, but I'm a tough love kind of guy. So folks got to understand, I'm gonna say what's on my mind, but I rock with these dudes. But you got to keep it 100. You got to keep it 100 when you talk about it. You know?
No, you do. And like I say, hot and cold. I mean, and that's the thing with him. I mean, he's been feast of famine. He's come in and played great. Toronto, 23 points. Golden State, 16 points. Distributing the basketball, 5, 6, 7 assists. And then sometimes, you know, when those 12-foot floaters going left aren't falling, you know, it can be frustrating, you know. And so anyway, but
you need his attitude, and you need that chip on his shoulder. He's got toughness. It's gonna pay dividends at some point. So you got to live through this stuff. You know, because he's going to pay dividends.
Well, and that's the thing to remember. We're just starting the season off, and if you had to grade him overall, I mean, he'd get a strong B, you know, maybe B plus. I don't know, depending on the, you know, what you're looking at. Strong B. I mean, no, he's had some great moments. I mean, Toronto, the way he took over the game down the stretch.
That one when he won the game was crazy.
Yeah,
The 24, was that Toronto?
Yeah, it was Toronto. Yeah, the takes to the basket, the going to the opposite side, and as Dekaius Duncan mentioned off air, with like he's been one of the better rebounding guards, even at 6'3". And what I like about him, fearlessness. I mean, he throws his body into the fray, just to tap out, keep the ball alive. You know, going for the tough rebound. So, yeah, I love that about him. I love rebounding guards, and so that leads me into this segue. One of the better rebounding guards in the game when he played, and just one of the better all-around players, passed away a few days ago. Really good friend of mine, Michael Ray Richardson, a.k.a. Sugar. And it's funny, Chris, how – not funny, but that's not the right term, but my mind is all over the place right now thinking about Michael Ray. But the reports had him, like, being recently diagnosed with prostate cancer. So everybody kind of assumed that, you know, he was diagnosed within the last few months, and all of a sudden now he's gone. Well, I sent him a text. I sent a text on the cell phone number, and just with the hopes of reaching somebody monitoring his cell phone. And so his wife actually got back to me and said that, and I asked her about the prostate cancer and how he was recently diagnosed, and was that the cause, and she said that he was actually diagnosed with prostate cancer, Chris, in 2015, 10 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, 2015 was when he was diagnosed. Now, in terms of it, you know, I don't know how it happened. Maybe, you know, it calmed down and then came. I don't know, but it was 10 years ago, and so that's just a message to men of all races, but especially African American men. When you get about 50 next week, a couple of days from now, when you get about 50, it's time to you know, just check yourself out and stay on top of that. And I think 50 is the age, or 60, maybe it's 60 is the age that they say that you know, because it can linger and you don't even know anything is going on, and all of a sudden. Well,
how about if you've already been on top of it, or you know, how about guys that are already doing that? Like, shout out to them, stay on top of it. If you're not,
stay on top of it.
Then yeah. Get on top of it.
Yeah, like, no, because I'm telling you, and I'm close to 70. And I'm talking from personal experience. It ain't no joke, you know, having to go through the whole process that you have to go through. But back to Michael Ray Richardson, man, he was one of my favorites, Chris. I don't know if you knew this, man, but we played against each other when he was a freshman at Montana. And I was at UCLA. I was a sophomore. Judd Heathcote was the coach. We narrowly beat Montana. Now, Michael Ray wasn't the reason why they were able to hang with us. They had this little 6'3", 6'4" white forward named Eric Hayes, lefty, had 34 points, 33 points against. He lit us up. But I remember interacting with Michael Ray, you know, from Denver, you know, kind of UCLA against Montana. His eyes were wide. You know, it was one of those situations. Reminds me when we played the University of Denver, when Sinbad was at the University of Denver playing basketball. This big red Afro brother at half court talking trash to me and Richard Washington. Richard Washington, you ain't nothing. Michael Johnson, I'm going to take you to the hole. I'm going to dunk on you, fool. You know, but Michael Ray was in that same mode, not as over the top with it as Sinbad. But that was the first interaction that we had. And then he dominated in the Big Sky. I think Big Sky Player of the Year 3 years after that. He was a guy, Chris, that when Judd Heathcote moved on to Michigan State and got Magic Johnson, Coach Heathcote has said that Michael Ray Richardson gave him that experience of coaching a big 6'5" guard. Magic's, you know, 6'8", 6'9", but Michael Ray was his first kind of project at the point guard in terms of a big guard. But Michael Ray, man, Chris, 4-time All-Star, 2-time All-Defensive First Team, Comeback Player of the Year in 1985, steals leader, led the league in steals and assists in the same season at that time, and there's been like three players to do it over the course of history of the league.
Stockton, him, and who else?
Stockton, Slick Watts, who passed away within the last year. Don Boosie, really, really good player for the Phoenix Suns back in the day, and Chris Paul. And so those are the guys that that have done that, led the league in steals and assists. But here's my deal. So we know, and if you don't know, I mean, so Michael Ray Richardson had issues with cocaine, like a lot of us did back in the day. He was went through 4 or 5 rehabs. He was banned from the league in 1986. They had the lifetime ban back then, tested positive, repeat drug test. But the league reinstated him, Chris, in 1988. So you can come back and play. You fulfill all the requirements we've laid out for you, the testing and the rehab and everything else we've laid out. You can come back. And Michael Ray, he told me this. He decided to stay over in Italy because he felt that was more conducive to him staying sober. And he wound up putting together 40-plus years of sobriety. But turn out the European leagues, European championships and top player over there and just kill it. Played until he was like 44, 45 years old. You know, can you imagine that? Out there balling at 45 years old, different leagues, France, Europe. So, Chris, here's my question to you. And this is just for conversation's sake, because I know it's probably not going to happen. But when you look at, like, the Europeans that are in the Hall of Fame, Dino Minahin, never played in the NBA, great Italian league player, played for Rome, I believe, or one of those great teams over there. Šarūnas Marcelionis, the great Lithuanian player, my teammate with Golden State for my cup of coffee with the Warriors. Tony Kukoc, who's really good, solid, you know, third, fourth wheel for the Bulls, second wheel. I mean, had some good years in the NBA, but not, you know, just total domination level. Drazen Petrovic was an up-and-comer. Arvydas Sabonis, more of a European fascination with him when he was younger, Russia, you know, jumping from the free throw line, dunking in an exhibition game over here when he was healthy. Then the Achilles injuries turned him to a great high post passer. Vlade Divac, I mean, he's, you know, Vlade was a good solid player. I mean, solid, not spectacular. I don't know if he made an all-star team as an NBA player. That's something to for us to look up. But you know, he did 15, 16 points a game, solid. 15, 16 points, you know, three packs of cigarettes a day. Played one all-star game. And so these are your so my thing is this. I mean, Michael Ray Richardson, yeah, he had his personal issues, you know, like a lot of us did. He got himself back on track, then went overseas and dominated for 15 years, whatever it was. If you can have European players get into the Hall of Fame on an international tip, and you got a Michael Ray Richardson who goes overseas and dominates the international basketball scene, does that not merit some Hall of Fame consideration at the very, very minimum?
I mean, that's if you view Michael Ray Richardson through the same lens as you view an international player, which the committee doesn't. They view him as someone that failed multiple drug tests, had a serious problem, so much so that he had to be banned from the NBA. That is how they view him. Now, how much credit he's been given for his recovery, for making it back, for transforming his life, for being sober, and for playing 44 years, I mean, for playing, you know, X amount of years, it's not a lot of credit. It doesn't get that. It doesn't dominate the headlines. He has this thing about his career, in my opinion, that will always follow him. It's like anybody from that.
It's a stigma.
Yeah, a stigma. It's you two. You have it. All the guys that went through stuff have it. Chris Washburn. I can name all the guys, man. And you
but
a certain level of stigma from that people seem to can't get over that are making decisions about Hall of Fame.
Right, but here's the point. I mean, so and that's as factual as it gets. But you got a Chris Mullin, who went through alcohol rehab as an NBA player. You got a Bernard King, very well documented substance use disorder issues. David Thompson. I mean, you got guys in the Hall of Fame, and those are the ones that just publicly we know about. I'm not going to throw anybody under the bus in terms of all the guys that are in there that were, you know, doing drugs back in the day. Everybody, you know, there's a lot of people doing drugs back in the day, but those are the guys that we know about publicly. So that stigma didn't keep them from being elected into the Hall of Fame. But I'm just saying, with Michael Ray Richardson, if you look at the fact that he was reinstated in 88, decided to and then again, for me, it gets into this too, Chris. You know, as opposed to looking at drug addiction as a moral failing, you know, lack of willpower. I mean, it's a recognized disease by the American Medical Association. Addiction is, and it's a chemical imbalance. It's all this endorphins and all this stuff, dopamine and all these terms that are way above my pay grade to talk about.
Right.
But if he was reinstated, decided for his health's sake, he's not going to come back into the NBA. And then dominates, not just plays overseas for until his 40s, but dominates. Bruh. You know, I'm just saying,
You're operating from this, it's a wonderful, what do they call these? Like utopian kind of a view where everything is gravy. It's not like that's, they're never going to view it through those lens, MJ.
Well, I'm saying, but that's the problem. What that says is that, if this is a medically diagnosed disease,
like
cancer or diabetes or something to that effect, why should it be held against a guy who not only overcame it and stayed sober 40 plus years, but also dominated overseas and came back to the States, coached in the CBA, coach of the year. And the CBA coach of the year, I think in Canada with one of their professional leagues or whatever, but also mentored. I mean, you look at a guy's body of work. I could see if he, you know, was banned, never came back, and then died this tragic death as a down and out drug addict, alcoholic, and oh yeah. But the way if you look at his the totality of his life and what he was able to contribute to the game of basketball, man. You know, so that to me means something that the voters, whether they will or not, they probably won't, as you say, but that's something that's worth something.
I wish that the voters saw things, or the people who are in positions to make decisions for things like the Hall of Fame saw things through these lenses, MJ. But the reality is they do not. So they look at things like addiction, in my opinion, like something that, okay, you could say it's a disease. I don't think they look at it like that. They look at it like y'all made a choice to get high, get faded, do what y'all did. Y'all made that choice. It wasn't no, oh, this is, you know, he got caught with cancer or he got AIDS because he was doing something. This was like, you know, this isn't. So it's going to take a while before folks look at it like that. And my Michael Ray Richardson experience, man, was so amazing because I had went overseas after UCLA on a tour team and we were playing in France in Marseille. And it was a big Marseille tournament. I ended up playing against Luis Scola. I gave Scola like 17 and 11 in the tournament for one of the top teams in Spain. But Lionel Hollins was my coach. So we fly over to Marseille. We chilling. Lionel tells me, because he knew the connection, you know, obviously Lionel and you. So he was telling me we're about to link up with Michael Ray Richardson. I was like, dang, we in France about to hook up with Michael Ray. Yeah. He's like, Michael Ray's got a restaurant over in between Marseille and Antibes. So we had to drive the French, you know, Riviera to get to Michael Ray's restaurant, dog. So we roll up in Michael Ray's restaurant and Michael Ray. And so to a little context, you know, on that tour team, it was like, you know, I kind of made it. They called it, the governor gave me a reprieve. I got cut at first and then somebody got hurt and then I ended up making the team. And so when I got over there, I was going through, you know, they were kind of trying to treat me like, you know, like boo-boo. And you know how I am with pride and things like that. When people disrespect me, you know how I get. So I'm dealing with that over there from Lionel. And so we ended up going to the restaurant. And then Michael Ray, man, I walk in, man, and he's like made this, like, hey, where's Chris? Where's Marcus's son? You know, it's like what Michael Jordan did with me before. But it was like he made this thing. I was just like, I felt like the most special person on the planet. Yeah. He made me feel like $1 million. We were sitting in the middle of France talking about you, talking about back in the day, how cold you were. So everybody, Michael Ray, he just talked about how cold you were. So we sat there for 30 minutes talking about how cold you were.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, man, it was just such an experience that, like, I ended up almost – like I ended up having like one of the best tournaments of my career after, you know, that conversation with Michael Ray.
Got your head you pumped up and feel. Feeling good about yourself and your game.
Back to myself, Ray, bro. And so that was my experience with Michael Ray. And then I would suggest everybody go back and listen to our podcast that we had with him last year.
Yeah.
It was a very riveting episode. It's deep. It gives a lot of insight into the man that he is, that he was. Rest in peace.
And that's my point. It's just what he was able to accomplish. I mean, that's another essence of greatness. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's one thing for a guy to be on the state straight and narrow. And trust me, I mean, a lot of these guys, Hall of Fame or not, I mean, everybody had their vices. Everybody back in the day, everybody was doing something, whatever, gambling or women or drugs or alcohol, whatever it was.
But MJ, it's about who doesn't get caught and who can maintain the public image and not have no police tickers going where you get caught up in
it's like we say in LA, you know, don't get in the system. Once they put you in the system, you know, you're forever in the system. But my point is that just from a personal level, knowing him, what he overcame, you know, to get banned from the league and New York City, you know, New York Knicks and Golden State and the New Jersey Nets at the time. Yeah. I mean, to get banned and you know, you could imagine just the depression and the self-hatred because you've let everybody down. But to bounce back and then not only bounce back, but bounce back with a flourish, man. That's what I respect so much about him. I'd say one of the funniest moments we had was in Japan. On a tour with a bunch of great NBA players, and Tiny Archibald, a bunch of guys. I forgot who hooked it up, but it was just a great tour.
Was it David Falk?
I don't think it was David Fogg, but Phil Smith, some of these old timers. Dr. J may have been there, but we just had a had a ball. Cassie Russell and all these kind of guys, Elvin Hayes and all that.
And so we're
playing backgammon in the hotel. But Michael Ray's playing against Artis Gilmore, man, and he's calling him Daddy Rabbit. Daddy Rabbit, yeah, watch this, Daddy Rabbit. I'm rolling 10, Daddy Rabbit. Ah, look. But it's the funniest. It was the funniest, and I remember it like it was yesterday because Artis couldn't stop laughing. I couldn't stop laughing. And if you know Sugar, he was just nonstop, and he stuttered and got excited when he talked and started spitting all over the place. Then the other thing about Sugar, when he was in Golden State, and he had come from the Knicks and the Nets, and he was in Golden State. Golden State was losing, terrible team. And the reporter asked him about how did it feel to be playing for a team like Golden State. And his great comment was like, the checks in New York are green. The checks in New Jersey was blue. The checks out here are pink. That's how I feel. You know, just talking about just he was getting paid. And so, but he just had this great sense of humor, man. And, like I said, I was just taken aback when I read about him passing away, and we had the privilege of having him on the podcast a few months back. He's got the book out now, Banned. If you want a good read, please pick it up on Kindle or wherever you can pick up your reading material. But we had him on a podcast, man, and it was just. It was just for me, just a really great reunion to be able to recount some of the stories and some of the times that we had, both good and bad. And so, Michael Ray Richardson, man, one of a kind.
Yeah, man, I'm sorry for your loss, bro. I know it's got to hit hard for the NBA fraternity, especially your era, man, because y'all are tight. You know, y'all crew is like, you know, my younger generation of guys. Look at how y'all are with each other, man, and so I can. I definitely can feel your pain. I'm sorry for your loss.
Well, Lenny, go ahead. Lenny?
No, I was going to say, rest in peace, Lenny Wilkins as well.
Yeah.
Like Lenny, for me, man, like Michael Ray and Antibes, South of France, kind of gave me that encouragement and that motivation. Lenny did the same exact thing for me when I went down to Hawks training camp. I was a rookie. I was there with the other rookies, Jeff Shepard, Rashawn McCloud, and Shamon Williams, the draft pick. So we were working out. We were in some runs, man. And I was having just an incredible day, incredible week, actually, of just, you know, running the floor, scoring, to the point where, you know, Lenny had really said anything to me all week. And on the last day, you know, he pulls me over to the side and he tells me, literally verbatim, and nobody's going to believe this, but he literally told me, he said, "You run the floor like my old teammate, John Havlicek." It's unbelievable. And I was just like, yo, what? And I had to go and find out. I think I asked you that. I had to hit you up like, yo, did Havlicek, was he a good runner? And you like broke it down on Hondo. And I was like, whoa, that's what Lenny told me, dog. So rest in peace, Lenny Wilkins. Rest in peace, Michael Ray Richardson.
Yeah, and rest in peace, Richie Adubato.
Richie
Adubato. Richie, you know, he's this thing goes in threes. So I'm trying to, you know, hey, angel of death, stay away from me. You got your three already. But no, Richie Adubato, long time assistant coach in the WNBA championships, in the media for a number of years. And he was the first one to go, and then Lenny, and then Michael Ray Richardson. But it's been a tough week for us ballers from that era. And to your point about the bond that we have, and a lot of it had to do with the different era. So there's no private jets. It's commercial. So you stayed overnight. You had to catch the first flight out the next day if you had a game the next day. But a lot of times we hung out together. You know, so me, Sam Lacy, Cliff Robinson from USC. I can just remember all, you know, Marvin Barnes. I remember in Buffalo, you know, we stayed at the same hotel when he was playing for the Braves in my rookie year playing with the Bucks, and you know, just hung out together, probably snoring more inside the room than outside. But it was a good time. It was a good time. But just those kinds of moments when you think back on, man. You said we got to keep it real, right? Got to keep it 100%, man. But that was the era. That was the era, man. That's
no, you know, more inside the room.
That was the era of the late 70s, early 80s. I mean, and cocaine was a thing. Yeah, cocaine was that yayo was it was flowing. It was a big time thing, man. And you know,
this is a family friendly podcast.
Yeah, AJ. Yeah. Well. Yeah.
But this is a real talk.
Yeah, yeah. It's real talk. And young people, I'm not encouraging you. I'm not advocating. I'm just telling you. You know, just. Take it from me. You don't want to go down that road. It leads to absolutely nothing. It turns out from good times to a nightmare real quick. And so anyway, but Michael Ray Richardson, man, I love the guy. I don't know if you knew this. He played high school basketball at Manual High School, the same school that produced Larry Farmer, number 54 at UCLA before I got there.
Yeah, you're
number 54. You're 54. Josiah's 54. Shiloh's 54. Cyrus's 54.
Will
Johnson,
54.
Jordan didn't volleyball, 54. Your daughter, yeah.
Josh,
so, I mean,
Moe.
Yeah, that's Josh and Moe, and that's our number. But anyway, so Michael Ray Richardson, though, man, just a special, special friend, person.
Yes.
And to me, just an example of resilience. And how to bounce back from adversity. Absolutely. And embrace life and make something good out of life after a really, really tumultuous, frustrating, depressing episode, and to show that it didn't have to end like that, that you can bounce back and flourish. And he finished with a freaking flourish, Chris. He finished
with
a flourish. And that's what I love about him. He, you know, just a zest for life. And you know, I miss him. I wish we'd have spent more time together. He had Otis Birdsong for years. And even to this day, I know last summer they were doing camps in Harlem for underprivileged youth for like years and years together. From their days, they started when they were with the New Jersey Nets back in the day. They were the backcourt.
They're still tight. Remember, because Otis was on the pod. He made the cameo on the podcast.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And they were doing a camp, right? And Otis was like, yeah.
Yeah, they were doing the camp. And so Michael Ray brought Otis in. Go check out the episode. It was an amazing, unreal episode for real basketball, NBA basketball heads.
Yep. Check it out. Michael Ray Richardson. Rest in peace.
Man, before we let you go, just tell us what you're doing now. You and Otis, I mean, just in terms of what you guys are doing, how you're giving back and helping
out
kids.
Well, we have a company called Ball Stars Youth Camps, and we've been doing it for the last 15 years, where we go across the United States doing free basketball camps for underserved kids. And we average about 150 kids a week.
Wow.
And what we do is, it's not only basketball, but we teach the kids life skills.
Yeah.
So, and it's been just unbelievable, bro.
And I would imagine you share a lot of your experiences, both good and bad, in terms of what you.
Yeah, of course.
And how are the kids today receptive to your story and your background?
I mean, a lot of kids are, but there's a problem with the marijuana stuff, because at one place they say the marijuana is legal, and then they say it ain't legal in certain different cities, right?
Right.
But what I try to explain to them, alcohol is also legal.
Yeah.
But if you really think about it, alcohol is the number one killer in the world.
Mm.
And there's liquor stores on every corner.
Yeah, yeah.
But that don't mean that you got to go out and drink.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Facts. Yeah. Well, look, man, you know, I'm just so thrilled that you're doing is the kind of stuff that you're doing, man. And I really believe, you know, you deserve some serious consideration for the Hall of Fame, man. And hopefully it'll happen one day. I mean,
you know, Marcus, I thought about it, and my mind is set as this: with my basketball resume, I should be in it, because my personal life had nothing to do with what I did on the basketball court.
Right. Well, and I'm going to tell you a quick story. When I didn't make it for the second or third time as a finalist, I forgot which, I was taking my daughter to a basketball tournament down in Orange County, about 45 minutes away. I dropped her off. Before I was going to go in, my phone lit up and it said Clyde Frazier. I was like, oh, boy, this is the day after I didn't get in. I got to answer this. Mm-hmm. I'll be late for the game. So I say, what's up, Clyde? He's like, man, F these MFs, man. F these mothers, man. F these mothers.
Yeah,
I didn't get in. They don't define who you are as a player and as a person.
Right.
Do not allow them to define who you are. And it was one of the most inspirational calls. Same to you, brother.
Yeah.
Same to you.
Yeah, but you're 100% right. Because let me tell you something. Those people that who are choosing people or who are voting people don't have a clue, bro.
Yeah, no, but yeah. But the most important thing is that you were down for a moment, but man, nobody can argue with the fact that you have risen from the ashes like nobody's business.
Yes,
and then the great stuff you've done and still doing, man. You deserve so many flowers while you're living, man. Keep on doing
it. I appreciate that, brother. I appreciate that, man.
Michael Ray Richardson, sugar, joining us on here, District. All right, we appreciate you.
Okay. Hey, Marcus, but you are the real MJ.
See, Chris, I told you, man. See,
yeah,
I already know.
Yeah, yeah.
I appreciate that, brother.